Okay, it's time, so let's begin. Today, well, let me get his picture up here. Today is the first class of our, of a couple classes. We only have two more classes this semester on Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin, one of the most creative and interesting rabbinic figures in the second half of the 20th century. I want to start, though, by pointing out, I guess it's coincidence or divine providence, that David Eisen emailed me something very interesting. If you recall, the end of last class, I mentioned what appears to be a drasha that Rav Meir Simcha developed on his own without any Talmudic or even medieval precedent. And then it was pointed out that it was more of like a diuk rather than a drasha. David pointed out to me that Rav Zevin, in his Moedim B'Halacha, in Yonah D'Yoma, dealing with Megillat Rut, he has a, I'll tell you the page if anyone has this edition, this is the edition I have, this is the standard edition now. Well, you can look, it's in Megillat Rut. He gives a number of examples of Achronim, recent, fairly recent Achronim, the last couple hundred years, who also do real drashot on their own. For example, he quotes Rav Pinchas HaLevi Horowitz, who derives something about Chalitin, that you must personally give over the Sudar. It's different from other forms of acquisition, and he derives that independently from a drasha. So I thought that was interesting, and thank you, David, for calling that to my attention. Regarding Rav Zevin, his life story is interesting, the eras he was in, and also what he accomplished. So we sort of take for granted today many of the things, as we'll see, many of the things that he was the first to do, we take for granted. The very notion of the halachic essay, halachic essays on different topics, you do not have that before Rav Zevin. And we'll see also his significance. Rav Zevin, it's sort of like we went from the Chasam Sof and the Ksav Sof, and then we did two classes on Moshe Kunitz, and then we went once again into a major figure. Rav Zevin, I wouldn't call him a major figure, although he had influence. Much of what we're going to talk about relates to what he was involved in rather than him personally. But he is worth discussing. There's a number of interesting points about him. And then, of course, we're going to move into, not this semester, I guess it'll be next semester, after the summer, Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector, who's a major, major figure. He's sort of the equivalent, I think, of the Chasam Sofer in the 19th century. Now, for biographical information, if anyone wants, a new edition of Ishim B'Shitot came out 4 years ago. It has, there's been a few editions, and this has all the material, including an article by Rabbi Zevin's grandson, which I'll have occasion to speak about. There's an article by Rabbi Yoshua Huttner from the Encyclopedia Talmudic about Rabbi Zevin, so those are both valuable. So let me begin. I also have a connection to Rabbi Zevin, and I've always been interested in him, and I've always had sort of a relationship to him in that he was the Rav, as we will see, of the city of Novozibkov. Novozibkov was also the city that the Aruch HaShulchan was Rav in, but that is the city that my grandfather came from. I mean, not my biological grandfather. My biological grandfather died, but this man married my grandmother, and he was my grandfather for many years, and he came from that city, and I will report some stories that he told me about Rav Zevin. Unfortunately, as is often the case, I didn't take advantage asking him things when I could have. The only things I knew were a few things he happened to mention, but I actually never asked him questions. And he had a brother, an older brother, who left the Soviet Union when he was approximately 20 years old, and he knew Rav Zevin very well. And the only thing I ever heard from him was that he went to Israel once, and he went to visit Rav Zevin, and how Rav Zevin had red hair. But other than that, I have to say that I never took advantage, and I've learned my lesson, and whenever I meet people who have good stories, I ask them. But that is my connection, and I will return to that in a little bit. Obviously, this was a Chabad family, or maybe not obviously. I'll give you details on the city of Novozibkov and my own family's Chabad a little later. Yidol points out that the same publishing company published Le'or HaHalacha. That is correct. I have the Le'or HaHalacha here. Here it is. Came out, it says, Mahadura Chadasha Im Hosafot Rabot, came out in 2004. They included a few more articles, some additions I see to the Shylock article. The truth of the matter is, if they would take Rav Zevin's writings, he published almost every week a column in HaTzofeh newspaper, and all these pieces in Lar HaLacha and Yishuv HaShitot, or most of them Yishuv HaShitot, originally appeared in HaTzofeh, there are still many, many articles which they need to put together, not to mention responsa, etc. How big is my library? Well, it's a good question. You're welcome to come visit one day and you could see. As I mentioned last class, nowadays people send me things. But I have to tell you, since you ask, Yishuv HaShitot is mine, but I actually bought this for, as you could see here, University of Scranton Library. Sometimes I run out of money. Space, it's okay. My wife hasn't threatened to divorce me yet, but sometimes I run out of money. So about 5 years ago, when this new book came out, I didn't have the money to buy it, so I had the University of Scranton buy it, and we have a very nice collection at the university. I'm the only one. Yes, the Sfarim crisis. It's not a joke. Okay. Rav Zevin is born in 1887 in a city in Belarus called Kazmirov. It was also his father was the Rav of the city. His family was Chabad. They had been Chabad for a few generations, but they were not Lubavitch. They were Bobroisk. If you recall a few classes ago, we spoke about Bobroisk. Their allegiance was to a different Rebbe. It was not to the Rashab. It wasn't any of those. It was to this man. I found a picture of him, the only picture there is, with Shamaria Noach Schneerson. Find it here. I believe I made a copy of it. The first time I ever saw this, here it is. The first time I ever saw this picture, there was there he is, Rosh Hashanah Noach Schneerson, in the front. It's the only picture we have of him, the Rabbeinu Rebbe. The first time I saw this picture, there was a journal put out about 13 years ago. I had a piece in one of the issues called the Hasidic Historical Review. It was put up by Shaul Shimon Deutsch, who currently styles himself as the Rebbe of Lyozhno. He's the one who wrote these books on the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Larger Than Life. Then he became his own Rebbe, and he's the one, when he left his studies of the Rebbe, he opened up this archaeological museum, this biblical archaeological museum. It's been covered in the Biblical Archaeology Review. The different yeshivas and the schools that take trips there. It is the largest private collection, apparently they say, the largest private collection of biblical memorabilia, archaeological stuff in the world. He must have very wealthy people backing him because he has some treasures, and this is a private museum in his house. The Torah Animal World. He is that too? I don't know about the Torah Animal World, so thank you for pointing that out. I know him from years ago. He mentions me in the book. I gave him important stuff, but I haven't been to his museum. I should take a trip there. And in one of the issues, Zalman Alpert, the learned librarian of Yeshiva University, has an article about, I don't remember if it was the Bobroisker or one of the people in Bobroisk, and he has this picture. And then I was looking for it online, and lo and behold, it is on the Hebrew Wikipedia, this picture. So you point out this is a branch in Lakewood now, too. Very interesting. So we spoke about the Bobroisker. I'm not going to go into details again. We spent a good 15 minutes about what Bobroisk was. I read somewhere that Novozibkov, the city that he became Rav in, was Bobroisk. It wasn't Chabad, which meant that my grandfather and great-grandfather, I know they were Chabad, that meant that they were Bobroisk. Unfortunately, out of all the things to ask, it never occurred to me because at the time, I mean, I was 21 or 22 when my grandfather died. But I have to say that I didn't know what Bobroisk was when I was 22. So when my grandfather, you know, when I would read and hear that, you know, Chabad, I just figured Chabad, the Lubavitch. And now my grandfather's in here. One of the questions I would love to ask him was, everyone in this city Bobroisk? I read somewhere that it was a city of Bobroiskers. But I would like to confirm that. Prior to Rav Zevin, there was a Rabbi Avraham Chaim, who was also Chabad, but I'm not sure if he was Bobroisk or not, or if he was an independent Chabad. In any event, these are the things that, if I ever meet Rabbi Zevin's grandson, maybe I can ask him, although I don't know if he knows. But as I said, I read that it was Bobroisk, and Rav Zevin's family was Bobroisk. Now, as we said, just to repeat, Rav Shamaria Noach Schneerson had thousands of Hasidim, And he was one of the most important rebbes in Russia. And if you look behind him there, that is his brother, Rav Shalom Dovber, who was also a rebbe. He was the rebbe of, I'm not sure how they pronounce it, Rizhitska, I think is how they pronounce it, Rizhitsa. It's one of the breakaways of Chabad. It closes up now. At an early age, Rav Zevin went to the Mir Yeshiva. That is, he wasn't, he was Chabad, but he wasn't Lubavitch. So he wasn't sent to the Lubavitch Yeshiva. Lubavitch have always had their own institutions, do their own thing. He instead was sent to the Mir Yeshiva, and he actually was a Chavrusa there with Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. And they had a relationship for many, many years. I even have a letter from Rabbi Weinberg to Rav Zevin. Following Mir, Rav Zevin went to Bobruisk. In Bobruisk, there was, we would today call it a kolel. In those days, they didn't call it a kolel, they called it a kibbutz. Like a kibbutz today in Israel. I've never heard the expression kibbutz used. I've never seen it used since prior to World War II. I don't know why they don't use it. Maybe some of you listening can point out if you know. But what it is, it's a gathering. It's a group of people who gather in a certain place. It's a kolel. And they studied under Rav Shemarya Noach. I don't know what it means when they say they studied under him. I guess he spoke to them, maybe the Mashir. He was a Talmid Chacham. All Chabad, pretty much, are Talmidei Chachamim. Not every Rebbe, but most of them. And the movement is a very intellectual movement. So we could see already here that Rav Zevin has this combination of profound Talmudic knowledge. That is, he's studying at one of the great yeshivas, the Mir. And he's also studying in Bobruisk. He's getting the Torah of the Bobruisk Rebbe. He's getting Chassidus. So it's a real combination, which is not that usual. Today, you will go to, if you go to Lakewood, you'll have all sorts of Hasidim there. You'll have lots of Satmar there. For some, and if you go to Israel, I know in Slobodka in Israel, I don't know about Chevron. Chevron might be too liberal, but in Slobodka Yeshiva, in B'nai Brak, you'll have many Satmar. I know myself personally, three Hungarian Satmar that went to study in Slobodka. You did not have much of this before the war. You, in fact, you hardly had any. One exception, by the way, is Rav Teichtel's son. We're going to have classes on Rav Teichtel, the Yom Avanim Smicha. He sent his son to Slobodka, and we have the letters of his son. But it was very uncommon for the Hungarians. They had their own yeshivas and their own way of doing things, so they pretty much did not go there. Now, I'm not sure what the attraction is to Slobodka and B'nai Brak today for the Hasidim, especially the Hungarian Hasidim. I know that it's a pretty extreme place. One of the Rebbeim there, his name is Rav Dov Lando, and he's famous for, among other things, writing an attack against the Shmir Shabbos Kel Chassa for coming out against Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arbach, for coming out against the Chazon Ish. But he also is supposedly never held of Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arbach, and he even referred to him as a Kupnik and a Mizrachiite. When you think of the Haredi world, Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arbach was an iconic figure, an idealized figure. So then when you see someone like Rabbi Dov Lando, whose attitude to Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arbach is he's a nobody, that he's another follower of Rav Kook, a Mizrahi person, you get a sense that it is an extreme place, and maybe some of the Satmar will be very happy there. Baruch points out that dropping the word kibbutz in favor of kolel, maybe because it took on a different Zionist connotation. I never thought of that. You might be right. Kibbutz obviously means something very different in Israel. It could be. Very interesting. Yeah, and kolel has meant different things as well. We've spoken about the groups in the land of Israel. It was called the kolel of, let's say, Hungary and of Austria. That just meant a group of people who were supported by their native lands. This attraction to Hasidus and this expertise, not just in traditional Talmud and Halakha and Hasidic literature, is seen in one of Rav Zevin's most beloved works, which was published numerous times and which is translated by Art Scroll. I'm referring to his Treasury of Hasidic Tales, which is, I think, two volumes. Rav Zevin's son mentions, his grandson, that is, Rav Nachum Zevin of Haifa, mentions that the great rabbis urged Rav Zevin not to publish this book because they said to write a book on Hasidic tales for a great Torah scholar, it isn't appropriate. But Rav Zevin did it, and this was part of his soul. When he was still young, his father dies. And the community, he was in his late teenagers, if I recall, and the community asks him to take over as rabbi. So very young, he takes over as rabbi. I don't know, 19 maybe. By this time, he already had smicha from the Rogachover, Rav Yosef Rosen, the genius, and Rav Zevin had a connection with him. They exchanged letters for the rest of the Rebbetzin's life, and in the book Ishi B'Shitot, there's a piece on the Rebbetzin. He had also received smicha from the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan, who always had very good relationships with Chabad, having been Rav in Novosibirsk. And also two Hasidic Rebbes, of course, the Bavoyska Rebbe, and also the other Rebbe with the picture we saw, the Rezitzer Rebbe. He received smicha from them. Not from the Rebbe of Lubavitch, mind you. Both of these, Bavoyska and Rezitzer, they were grandsons of the Tzemach Tzedek and leaders in Chabad. Already as a young man, I mean, we said that he's born in 1888. When he was 20, 21, 22, he already has a beautiful Hebrew style. And we have articles he wrote during that time. We have letters he wrote. He even has one or two little pieces in Hameles, which was the Haskalah journal. The journal Hamodia, which appears in Poltava, the Ukraine, from 1909 to 1913. Now, the Hamodiah you have in the land of Israel, beginning in, I think it's 1947 or 48, that's the Aguda paper that is, they picked a name, and they wanted a name, so they picked the name Hamodiah, which was published, as I said, in Poltava by Elijah Rabinowitz, formerly Mizrahi, later anti-Mizrahi. What was this newspaper Hamodiah? It's not anything like the Hamodiah in Israel today, or now the English newspaper. Those newspapers, Hebrew and English, are papers for the masses, for everyone. However, the masses in Eastern Europe could not speak, read Hebrew. Their language was Yiddish. Hamodiah was the newspaper of the yeshiva, of the rabbinic elite, which included the yeshiva people, the rabbinic elite. In my book on Rabbi Weinberg, I quote a number of his early articles there. The only place in America you can get the entire run is at Harvard, because they have the microfiche from Hebrew University. This newspaper is still not online. You can get most of it at YIVO. When I went to study this newspaper, to read through it, because I wanted to, when I dealt with my Rabbi Weinberg, I wanted to get a sense of what it meant to be a rabbi in the Russian Empire in the early years of the 20th century. And then I started coming across these articles by Weinberg, and of course it blew me away. I was very excited, because these were articles that no one had seen in many decades, and no one knew about, had written about. I also found articles by Rabbi Zevin, articles that have never been reprinted. And this newspaper, Hamodiah, was, the people who wrote in it were the younger rabbis, not the old-time rabbis, the Gedolei Yisrael. It was the younger rabbis, and they wrote in a beautiful Hebrew. And part of this newspaper was to show that we too, the rabbis, can also write a beautiful Hebrew, to take back the language from the Maskilim. Because if the older rabbis, they could only write really Torah studies, and they wrote an Aramaic type of Hebrew. Here you have young rabbis. Rabbi Weinberg is one of them. Rabbi Prale, Yosef Yehoshua Prale is another one. And Rav Zevin is another one. Then there's tens and tens of these young rabbis who had read all the Haskalah literature. They had read Makpu and Smolensk and the rest. And instead of turning on orthodoxy, they were now writing in the most beautiful Hebrew to show the Maskilim that we too can write in Hebrew, and this is our language. Remember, if you speak about great Hebraists, you can go back to people like Rav Moshe Chaim Watzlato and many others. And the truth is that in the 19th century, Hebrew skills, the ability to write the beautiful Hebrew, was really given up by the Orthodox. They weren't called Orthodox then, but given up by the Torah community and adopted by the Maskilim. And this was the attempt of the young rabbis, and Rav Zevin is one of these young rabbis, to write in Hebrew, be Hebrew stylists, I'll give you some examples now. Baruch says, what about the people giving him smicha, that the other rabbis were more halachist than the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Yeah, I don't know the details. By this time you're dealing with the Rayats. Actually, no, it wouldn't be the Rayats. Be the Rashab. I'm not sure. I just mentioned that. I don't know if I can read anything into the fact that he didn't get to it from Lubavitch. But I don't know how much connection there is to Lubavitch at all. The Rashab was a great Talmud Chacham. None of these were really halachas per se, I don't think. Unlike the Rayats, the Rashab was a great Talmud Chacham. I will speak about the Rayats a little bit later today, because Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, he's a very strange person to be the Rebbe. some of the things he wrote. I'll get to that in a little while. Well, since you bring it up, let me mention it now, and then I'm going to tell you a bit about what Rezevin wrote. Why do I say the Ryatz is a bit unusual? Well, he becomes Rebbe, he takes over for his, and then we're going to deal with Ryatz a lot soon, because Rezevin and Ryatz work very closely. Rezevin is one of the Yosef Yitzchak Shniosim, the Friedrich Rebbe's men in Russia. Since when do Hasidic Rebbe's give smicha? I don't know. He got smicha from two of them. What do I mean when I say the Ryatz is a bit strange? He writes these things, which, well, let me begin with a story. I told you last semester how when I was in Venice in the winter, we'll be back, God willing, in Venice in another month, there was this real kanai there from B'nai Brak, who was there on Hashkacha. He had been sent, and he's the guy that tried to convince me that you could not rely on OU Hashkacha, that it was absolutely not reliable. The only thing he thought was reliable was the OK and the Hamish Hashkachas. I said to him, he didn't believe me, I said to him that literally every Vod in Kabbalah Kashrus in America relies on the OU. He said, you can't eat in America if you don't trust the OU, and he didn't believe me. And he starts rattling off some names of people who says, oh, I know they don't trust the OU, these rabbis in Williamsburg, etc. So I said to him that I'm not talking about these people in Williamsburg. I mean, in Israel, the OU is nothing. It's meaningless. So he thinking of the OU as just some little ashkacha of unreliable people. And I said to him that, you know, these Hamish ashkachas, yeah, they don't rely on the OU. So you have these products that have the OU and the Hamisha, but whatever. I explained to him the situation. He didn't believe me. Now this Kanai, who was davening in the Chabad Messianic Minyan, and he was eating in the Chabad restaurant, so he told me there's no problem to eat there just because they're crazy, you can eat there. We were talking to an Israeli. There was an Israeli with us, and we got to talking about the Rav Yosef Yitzchak Shneerson, and I mentioned that he wrote a book, it's been translated to English, his memories of the Tzemach Tzedek and the Haskalah movement, and I said that there's a lot in there that's not reliable. Now, and this Kanai from B'nai Brak, who was close to Rav Chaim Kanievsky, who was a big Yodea Sefer, he had a very big library, he interrupted me and said, you say that there's passages in that book that you can't rely on? He says, find me one passage in that book that you can rely on. So here is someone saying that you can't rely on it at all. Now, the Friedrich Rebbe, he also, there was this forged collection of Hasidic letters called the Cherson Archive. Everyone knows it's a forgery. It's obvious it's a forgery. The Rebbe wrote about it, but I mean, it's so obvious. But he accepted it. Now, this is so problematic that his secretary, Lieberman, Chaim Lieberman, the one who turned on Rav Nachman El Shneerson and the Satmar had to rescue him, he was a great Chabad historian, and he knew all about Hasidus, and he obviously couldn't accept the Cherson Archive. So they asked him, but the Friedrich Rebbe accepted it. So all he could say was that, I can't tell you why he said publicly that it's real, but I know he didn't believe it. The other people in Chabad, like Munshein and Lowenthal, they know it's fraudulent, but you can't speak publicly about it because the Rebbe Ryatz accepted it, these phony letters of the Baal Shem Tov and others, and Rabbi Nachman El Shneerson also accepted it based on that. So among people who study, no one's ever written a biography about Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. But if you wrote a biography, you'd have to analyze this. And among people who've written about this, there's two approaches to it. That is, I'm not talking about Chabad types. One approach is that the Ryatz is basically, you know, there's no fiction allowed in Orthodoxy, ultra-Orthodoxy. So if you want to write fiction and you want to create stories, you have to make it seem historical. We know about this, about Udo Rosenberg, the rabbi from Toronto and Montreal, who invents all these crazy stories about the golem, which are completely fraudulent, and he gives hints to you that they're fraudulent. He hints, he leaves various hints, which I could tell you another time. So he writes because he wants to do literature, so he invents stories. So you could say the same thing about the Ryatz. He's creating these stories. The other approach is, and I've seen both of them in print, is that, actually online, see both of them online in discussions on these Haredi websites, is that the Ryatz was naive. That is, he heard these stories from elderly Chabad Hasidim, and he just reported them. So there's two ways. One is that the Ryatz is naive, and he just repeats nonsense that he hears, stuff that we know is nonsense historically, or that he basically wants to create a certain type of literature, and he just makes up these things. I don't know which is portrays him in a better light, but there definitely is something to be said and some analysis necessary on the Rayatz. Baruch says that even the Hamish Hashlachas rely on the OU. Okay, well that's, they relied on ingredients. I don't know if everyone does. I mean, why would they need the separate Hashlacha if they all rely on it? But you know better than me. If you tell me they rely on it, then I agree they rely on it. But this guy didn't rely on it. He said you can't rely on it. Is that all the people? Is that Satmar? Is that Bells? I don't know. All I'm saying is that this guy refused to... I rely on it. What can I tell you? I rely on it. The OU is careful. Even though the OU is a modern Orthodox organization, supposedly, they are very careful that they hire all sorts of people from all the different yeshivas to do their hashkachas so that they'll be relied upon in all these circles. They have people from all the different yeshivas. And they don't just have one posseg. Why don't you just have a Frischel Schechter? They have Rebelski, and Rebelski is not well now, and he might have to retire soon. So, of course, they're going to hire someone. They have to hire someone from the yeshiva world. You'll see they'll do that again. They used to not do this years ago. In the 1960s, they didn't have this. And in the 1960s, and I think probably into the 1970s, they were not relied upon. There are many people who didn't, but they're very smart. Okay, you tell me that something relies on it. If I see this Kanai again, I will tell him that even Satmar relies on the OU. Okay, very good. We're getting let's move on. As I said, already as a young man, he had developed this Hebrew writing style. And just to give you one interesting example of the articles that I found in Hamodia from Rav Zevin. Rav Zevin writes an article about a topic that today most people know nothing about. And that is, I referred to it in my book on Weinberg, Rabbi Weinberg, so if you read the book, you know about it. That is the sale of the rabbinate. Rav Zevin has an article about the scandal, we're talking in the early 20th century, of people buying the rabbinate. I don't know in the more traditional circles. We have a number of people from those circles online. You could tell me if you've ever heard of anyone buying a rabbinic position. When I say buying it, I mean paying off the machers, giving them gifts, or just money so that they appoint you. In many communities, the machers really make the decision on these sorts of things. At least they did in Europe. In Europe, if you didn't pay taxes, if you were so poor, as many were, that you didn't pay communal taxes, you had no say in deciding communal policy who would be the rav, and you always had had machers. So Rav Zevin writes about this. What is this idea of buying the rabbinate all about? As I said, it's something today... you can't even imagine it. You can imagine buying the rabbinate in a different way. That is, maybe getting on close terms with the machers and having your father-in-law, you know, kiss up to them or do them favors. But just buying them presents, that's not something we can imagine today. Yeah. But for hundreds and hundreds of years, this was an issue in the Jewish world of purchasing the rabbinate. We know it was an issue. First of all, it's even referred to in the Talmud. And all the codes, halacha codes, speak about, codify that you can't purchase a rabbinic position. There were many cheirims, going back to the 1600s and perhaps even earlier, cheirims against buying a rabbinic position. Obviously, people were doing it. One rabbi went so far as to blame the massacres, the pogroms of 1648, which before the Holocaust was really the worst thing that we had. He blamed it on the sin of selling the rabbinic position. Rav Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, we're going to do classes on him, the rabbi of Prague, until his death in 1867, he writes with pride that he broke with the universal practice and refused to shower the communal leaders with presents. That is, the community would bring in rabbis to have their Shabbos there, their tryout Shabbos, and they all would bring in presents, and that's how they would pay off the rabbis, pay off the community leaders. Rappaport writes that he never did such a thing. By the end of the 19th century, purchase of the rabbinate was so prevalent that two of the greatest poskim in the late 19th century, one actually into the 20th century, Rav Yitzchak Shmukas and Rav Shalom Shvadron, the Maharsham, you can't get any bigger than them, certainly not bigger than the Maharsham, they were led to defend the practice. Since in their day, they write that community leaders won't even consider your candidacy. You can't even get to the door if you don't pay off the community leaders. Therefore, it's permissible. It's almost like going down into Africa or South America, where unless you pay off the right people, you won't even be able to get a chance to have to bid on a contract. You would not even have a chance. You would not be invited to the community to put forth your candidacy, to have your tryout Shabbos, unless you paid off the community leaders or the ones who made that decision. Can you imagine today if to become rabbi in the town, to come in for your tryout Shabbos, you have to pay off people? Therefore, these two great poskim say that since the only way you'll get a chance is by paying them off, it is permissible to do it. Obviously, these things were not done in public. These were all done privately. Now, Rav Zevin, in his article, in Hamodia, and in my book on Rabbi Weinberg, I translated this passage, he, in his discussion of how crazy this is and how outrageous, he calls attention to an advertisement that appeared in a newspaper in 1910, 1911, I forget the exact year, in which a rabbi advertises in the newspaper for another rabbi. Any rabbi can come and buy his position from the community. Let me read you this advertisement that appeared black and white in one of the newspapers, one of the Jewish newspapers in Eastern Europe. Notice to rabbis, I wish to leave Bashlova in the Grodno district and travel, God willing, to the Holy Land. But the citizens of this town must still collect money in order to pay their debts to me, approximately 2,000 rubles. That means that the community, they were behind on his salary. Therefore, any rabbi who has this amount can, with my permission and with all certainty, come here to accept the position of rabbi in this community. In other words, anyone who would pay off the debt of the community, the 2,000 rubles, he would get the position. Who was signed? Rafael Gordon, rabbi of this town. Now, this Rafael Gordon is not a nobody. We know who he is. He was a big, big Talmud Chacham, and a Talmudist, and he published a sefer with his Talmudic notes. Unfortunately, he's come down to history as the one best known. He was the leading Talmudist, really the only great Talmudist, who defended Solomon Friedlander's forged Yerushalmi. So much so that Rav Meir Don Potsky, he wrote a whole book against the forged Yerushalmi, suggests that perhaps Gordon, Rafael Gordon, he actually is the one who forged it and wrote it, because why else is he out in front so much defending it? But this Rabbi Rafael Gordon, who was a real Talmud Chacham, he advertises, and the community agreed with this, that anyone who is willing to pay off the debts, pay the community leaders, I guess it's not a bribe in the sense that it's not going to the community leaders' pockets, but you can buy the rabbinic position, and this is what the Chayrim was all about in past years. You can't have a situation where people can buy the rabbinic position. And there are lots of other articles. I hope one day they collect all these articles and publish them. He served a few communities in Russia after Kazimirov. He goes to, as I said, the last one was Novozibkov. That's where the Archa Shulchan earlier was in the 19th century before he moves on to Novardik. Let me tell you a story I heard from my grandfather. This story has never appeared in print. Actually, it appeared on the Sporting Blog. I put it on, so it has appeared now. I told this in a letter when I was corresponding with Rabbi Nachum Zevin, the grandson of Rav Zevin, who I'm not sure, I've never met him, I'm not sure if he identifies with Chabad today, or how close he identifies, but I told him the story. Now, Novozibkov, during World War I, as we know, many people were displaced. And there were Jews from various towns who were displaced from their towns, and they were going on long marches to finding other places. And a group of Jews were marching through Novozibkov, or they're coming to Novozibkov to march through. They would come, and they didn't live in these places because the community couldn't. They'd stay for a few days, and then they'd have to move on. The community might be able to take a few of them, but You couldn't let a whole new community come in. They didn't have the money to support them. But the people in Novoziphkov heard that among the displaced Jews that were passing nearby was a great scholar. He was the Rav of the another local community. And they did not have a Rav at this time, and they invited him to become Rav of Novoziphkov. He accepted it. He lived in my great-grandfather's house, my grandfather's house, and my, obviously my grandfather was a child. He lived with my great-grandfather. He lived, or Zevin lived in my great-grandfather's house for 6 months, I was told, before they gave him his own house. So that is my family connection. It's interesting what happened to my family. I will get to that soon. Out of all the mistakes that Chabad has made, in my opinion, the worst mistake is the one that left my family and so many others in the Soviet Union, so lost to Judaism forever. I will tell you this story very soon. It's interesting that in 1910, in another article in Hamodia, Rabbi Zevin writes about the need to open up girls' schools, which will give wide-ranging secular education in addition to Torah education. He writes this article before anyone is speaking about Beis Yaakov. Beis Yaakov is not being talked about. There is no Beis Yaakov. And Rav Zevin is writing about the need to educate girls, not just in Torah, of course in Torah, but also on secular subjects. His grandson, in the introduction to Mishi Meshito, tells the following interesting story. The story comes from the Chafetz Chaim's son, Rav Leib. One year there was, I assume this is when he was in Novoziphkov, one year there was very little food, and Rav Zevin wanted to permit kitnios on Pesach. This was always a thing in Europe. There would be a famine, or it would be hard to get food. It's not like today where we have food is easy to come by. And we had great rabbinic figures who would permit kitniot. There was a number of times in the late 19th century where kitnios was permitted. One thing which I haven't yet been able to determine is we've never, as far as I know, in all these times where they permit kitniot, I've never seen them say, well, we'll permit one form of kitniot, but not the other forms. That is, that we permit, let's say, corn or just one form, then for that you can eat, but still hold of the practice of abstaining from kitniot for the other ones. It seems, at least as far as I can determine, it seems that when they permit kitniot, they permit it entirely. So one year there was very, very little food, and Rav Zevin wanted to permit kitniot on Pesach. And he wrote a response, and he sent it to the Chafetz Chaim. And the Chafetz Chaim started to write a responsum permitting it. We don't have many responses really of the Chafetz Chaim, but perhaps for this reason, he started to write a responsum, but then he stopped, and instead he sent word that he doesn't agree with the Heter. He told Rav Zevin he doesn't agree with the permission. Why not? Well, what's wrong? Rav Zevin's a great scholar, and the community needed needed this food. I guess the Chafetz Chaim also assumed that he could ask another Rav if it was really so important. The Chafetz Chaim, according to his son, told his family that he couldn't write the responsum because he was afraid that eventually the responsum would be published, as all these responses are. The Chafetz Chaim knew who he was. In the early 20th century, there aren't many figures more admired than the Chafetz Chaim. Anything the Chafetz Chaim writes will eventually be published. And he did not want an emergency responsum, that is, this tshuva he was going to write, which was going to permit kitniot, this would be a horat shah, an emergency responsum. He didn't want this to become a responsum l'dorot, for the generations. That is, if it was then published, people would then refer to and use it to try to abolish kitniot at other times. We have other examples of great rabbis who would not put in print their decisions, not because they were afraid of being attacked or anything like that. There are plenty of rabbis, even great rabbis, who would not put their psak in print because they're afraid of being attacked. I know the Torah tells us that we're not supposed to, Saguru, you're not supposed to be afraid, but the truth is that there are terrorists out there, talking about Jewish terrorists, not the type that kill you, but the type that will destroy your life. And there are people who are afraid to publicly put themselves out there. Some posting have no fear, but yet they still won't put it in print because they're afraid of it might be used incorrectly. We will deal, when we deal with Rabbi Yitzchak Spector, with his permission for the sale of the land, the Heter Mechira, in the sabbatical year. According to Rav Chaim Moser Grzynski, the reason Rabbi Yitzchak Spector never published this responsum which was circulated among great rabbis, but the reason he never included it in his collected responsa was precisely because he didn't want this to be in print so that people could see it. It's an emergency responsa, and if in the next Shemitah year you need to do it again, fine, you do it again as an emergency. But once you put it in print, it then becomes a text that everyone can look back to and use, and it shouldn't be that way. Ritzi Pesach Frank engaged in some very radical decisions when it came to Mamzerus. We know, for example, we spoke about this when we dealt with Ritzi Pesach, that he permitted Mamzerim to remarry by utilizing the Maharsham, or Shalmashvadron, we mentioned him already, his procedure where you send a shliach to divorce a woman, and then you cancel the shliach, and then the marriage is ab initio voided, which is a notion which the Maharsham suggests maybe a way to stop Mamzerus, although Maharsham never used it in practice. Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank, Halacha L'maisa, used this and freed Mamzerim after the Holocaust, when women had remarried and had children, or at least in one case he did it. He never published this and wouldn't put it in print again, so that people will not rely on this responsa. Rav Zevin was in Russia, and then the revolution happens. And many, many great rabbis were stuck behind the Iron Curtain. Many of them were able to escape. First of all, many of the rabbis were now in Lithuania, and that becomes an independent state. But many were able to escape. But here's an example where being a rabbi is a good thing for you. Because at least if you're a rabbi, there's always communities that need you. In America, many of them went to America. There was South Africa and other places. And you could get out in the early years, that is, in the early years of Russia, at least since the late 1920s, you could leave if you had a position waiting for you somewhere else. America wouldn't let you in just by coming. But if you had a position waiting for you in other countries as well, including the land of Israel, Palestine, you could go. Even after the White Paper, you could go if you were a rabbi. An average person, they couldn't get out because they could never get a visa to enter another country, but a rabbi could. So many of the rabbis got out, but not all of them, and many were stuck behind the Iron Curtain. Rav Zevin remains. He doesn't try to get out. He's still in Novozukov. And he's involved now in underground activities in spreading Judaism. In the first few years of the communists, Judaism still went on. It wasn't so difficult. Then it begins to be very difficult, in particular because the Jewish component, the Jewish wing of the Communist Party, is engaged in a lot of persecution. Rav Moshe Feinstein is still in the Soviet Union this time. Any rabbi, though, who wanted to, who could get out, did. It's very unusual. Rav Zevin is one of the few, apparently, who didn't try to get out. And then within a few years, everyone knew that you had to get out. Many of them saw immediately that you had to get out. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, for example, he leaves Chasavich in 1921. The Chafetz Chaim was in Belarusia and in the Ukraine until 1921, and then he leaves with his yeshiva to Radin. The impetus for this decision was that the local authorities started to force the yeshiva students to perform various labors on Shabbos, and he, in said that in such a circumstance, when people are going to be forced to violate Shabbos, union leave even on Shabbos. This was so ingrained in people that it led to a very unusual psak, even after the Iron Curtain fell, by Rav Shaul Yisraeli. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Harav, one of the leaders of religious Zionism, the author of Amud HaYamini and Chavos Ben Yamin, who we'll have classes on, he is one of those people stranded in the Soviet Union. His father was a Rav. His father, like so many rabbis, was later sent to Siberia, never to be heard from again. Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli and two other students, they make their way to Moscow, where there's a Rabbi Kelmis there, who ends up eventually himself making his way to the land of Israel because he's a rabbi and he's able to come. While in Moscow, they don't know if they should try to escape over the border into Poland, because if you're caught, you'd be executed. And they do the Gora Hagra, the lottery of the Vilna Gaon, and the pasuk comes up that they should try to escape, and they do escape. And they make it into Poland, and from there they go to the land of Israel, and Rav Shaul Yisraeli becomes one of the great students, one of the last students of Rav Kook. Even after the Iron Curtain fell in the early 1990 or 1991, Rochelle Israeli writes a responsum in which she says that if the Jews can leave in Russia, that they should leave immediately, even on Shabbos. Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt, who is the Rav to this day, he was the Rav then and is still the Rav of Moscow. I think he's the official Rav of Moscow. Someone else is the Rav of the Soviet Union. He's also the Abbasin, a big time to Chacham. He writes, and I'm holding a copy of it here right now, in Hamayan, an article respectfully disagreeing with, Rabbi Israeli, basically saying that how can you matter Chil Shabbos today? Today, there's no more Iron Curtain. There's no more Pikuach Nefesh Ruchani. There's no more spiritual Pikuach Nefesh. So, there's no permission whatsoever to leave on Shabbos. And, it's hard to agree with Rochelle Israeli that in 1990 or 1991 that you could say that people should, leave on Shabbos. But you know something? This is 2020 hindsight. Remember the coup, the attempted coup in 1992? Let's say that coup succeeded and the communists were put back into power and people who had a chance to leave the prior Shabbos didn't leave because they said, well, I can leave, I'll leave later during the week. And then they're stranded there. Then we'd all look like idiots. But this is Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, and perhaps based on his experience, he did not trust the changes that were going on in Russia. And from his attitude, if you can leave, even on Shabbos, you must get out of there as soon as possible because it's Ruchani. Yes, Baruch points out that he was fleeing. He was returning, obviously, to Radin. Other leaders left. The leaders of the Hasidic leaders of the Chernobyl branch. You have the Skver, you have Trisker, Rachmistrifker. They all left the Soviet Ukraine during the early years of Soviet rule, taking all their followers with them, and Rosh Yeshiva, who had spent the war years in Russian-controlled territory, were quick to leave, go back to independent Lithuania, Vilna was part of Poland, and everyone, all the rabbis and all the Rosh Yeshiva, the message was one thing, leave if you can. They were telling everyone to leave the Soviet Union. Obviously, a dictatorship had just come to power, whose basic ideology was anti-religious. The Tsar, for all the problems living under the Tsar, he was not concerned pretty much with how you lived your private life. It was an authority, to use Jean Kirkpatrick's famous distinction from her famous commentary article in defense of Ronald Reagan's policies, there is a distinction between an authoritarian regime and a totalitarian regime. Tsarist Russia was an authoritarian regime. There were no political freedoms. However, there was economic freedom and there was religious freedom. And as long as you were not interested in getting involved in politics, you could have religious freedom there. The Soviet Union and the communist ideology was a totalitarian ideology. And everyone knew that that was its intent. And it was opposed to religion, believed in uprooting religion, the opiate of the masses. And anyone who could see clearly, it was obvious it was only a matter of time before religion, they began to persecute religion. Not just Judaism, Christianity. Their prime persecution was against Christianity. They turned the churches into a Soviet bastion, that is, the Russian Orthodox Church became an outpost of communism, and they made it clear that the only people permitted to go to churches, that is, legally, according to the Soviet Constitution, anyone could go to church, to synagogue. However, if you wanted to advance in society at all, if you didn't want to be fired, if you wanted to have any place in society, you could not be seen in a synagogue or a church, and therefore it became places for the older people. I said about the Chassidish Rebbe, they took many followers with them, and they encouraged them all to leave, obviously. You have many of these areas which were Hungary then. Munkács is one of them. They became part of the Soviet Ukraine. They became controlled. Some did, and some only after World War II. Munkács is only after World War II. But others were part of, were in the Ukraine. You had Hasidim there, even if the Rebbes weren't there. And that was the message from everyone. Get out of the Soviet Union. The Rayats, but the Square Rebbe, Baruch, if you check it, I believe I'm correct, the Square Rebbe was himself in Soviet territory in Ukraine. The Rayats didn't leave and didn't want people to leave. He had a completely new perspective. a different perspective. He sent his followers were called the Tmimim. They were called the Tmimim because they were members of something called Agudas HaTmimim, which was an association of former students of the Tomchei Tmimim Yeshiva in Lubavitch. They still use this term, Tomchei Tmimim Ma. And he sent them to preach, to give drashas in the various shuls in the Soviet Union, to support, to encourage the life of Jews in the Soviet Union. Now, Soviet law at this time prohibited teaching religion in school, and they passed a law, and the secret police, and in particular the Jewish division of the Communist Party, moved aggressively against the Cheders and against the Melamdim. They were shutting them down. It was decided that Rav Zevin had a very good Russian ability, that he would inquire an official request of the Soviet government, to the, I think it was the Interior Ministry, of whether private instruction of religion at home in groups of five or six children was permissible under Soviet law, because the Jewish communists were stepping in and putting a stop to all Jewish education, saying that the Jews were at this time being educated in cheders still, that it was forbidden. The answer given was that this was permitted according to Soviet law, and notarized copies of this decision given by the Soviet government were sent throughout the country. That is, that cheders are permissible, that you can teach Jewish children in groups of five or six, and that is protected by the Soviet Union. In the summer of 1925, when really it was obvious to anyone that there is no future for Jewish life, and anyone who wants to get out was trying to get out, except for certain rabbis, it needs to be said that certain rabbis felt that they had a responsibility to their communities, but any individual was trying to get out. The Rayatz, however, issued his definitive statement on emigration. No emigration from the Soviet Union. A Lubavitcher had written to him asking permission, not a rabbi of the community, but just a Lubavitcher, and all Lubavitchers are involved in Torah teaching, or should be involved, in supporting their neighbors in Yiddishkeit. He had written to the Rebbe, and his letter is published, Rebbe's response, asking permission to leave for Eretz Yisrael. The difficulties in observing Judaism were overwhelming. His own children were leaving Judaism. It was almost impossible to raise Jewish children in the Soviet Union. Of course, it is true that there were a few families who, when the Soviet Union fell, had still been Shomer Shabbos for all these years, but these are minuscule, tiny. My own family. Of the four, there was eight children. Four came to America, four remained in the Soviet Union. All of them assimilated. When we finally were able to get contact again, when the Iron Curtain fell, one of the nephew of my grandfather, as my grandfather's brother's son, he came to America. He was already in his late 50s. Of course, he's intermarried. They're all intermarried. When you think of it, the Rayatz, if you're in terms of judgment, this decision that they have to remain, I'm sure some didn't listen to him, but of the ones who remained almost entirely, and I'm speaking of my own family, were assimilated after 7 years of forced indoctrination into the Soviet system, where it was literally impossible to be an observant Jew, that was the only result, and I believe he should have seen it. And what was the Rayatz's answer? Let me read you the Rayatz's answer. In English translation, the person who wrote to him is a shliach of Lubavitch. Whatever shliach means, I don't know. But this was his viewpoint for all his followers. We must understand, this is what he's writing to the Lubavitch shliach, and then this letter is sent to everyone. This is a letter to all of his followers. We must understand that we did not come to this land by chance, and not by chance have we encountered the bitterness of exile, darkness, and hardship. It is the will of God, blessed be He. He demands of us that we light up the darkness of this land with the light of Torah and Tefillah. So the Rebbe is telling them that your role here is to light up the Soviet Union with the light of Torah. The time has come for every one of us to understand this and not look here and there in search of other places. The time has come for us to understand that we have been given a mission in life, the mission of aiding our brethren here in this land. And the Rebbe stays himself. He's not like one of these Rebbes who leaves and his followers remain. He stays there. He goes on. I say to you explicitly, you must stop thinking thoughts about leaving. Instead, you should concentrate on the mission with which you are charged to assist our brethren and strengthen the study of Torah. When I think of those Hasidim who do not pay attention to their mission and obligation and exaggerate the degrees of obstacles and hindrances, my soul becomes heavy. I cry on account of them. The burning question today is, what will become of the Torah? Why then is everyone turning to his own little corner, concerned only about his personal affairs and thinking day and night only about himself, about where it will be better for him, in the land of Israel or the United States? Why doesn't he consider or take to heart that he, only he, is to blame for the situation from which he is fleeing, I guess because of their sins? The Rebbe reiterates in this letter the advice that his great-grandfather had given to a chassid of his, an early chassid of Chabad, who asked to leave for the land of Israel in the 1850s. What did the Rebbe say? Mandarf machado Eretz Yisrael. We should make this the land of Israel. Create a land of Israel here. So the Rebbe, Dreyatz, unlike all the other Rebbes in Rosh Yeshiva, tells his followers that they have a mission. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. But they cannot abandon the rest of Jewry here. They must remain and turn this darkness into something where there could be Torah. I see it. If you're talking about America, which was a desert then, a midbar, you wanted or places, even if you were in Africa or places like that. But in retrospect, it's clear. But not only in retrospect, I think it should have been clear even at the time that this was a hopeless mission in the Soviet Union, and it basically meant sacrificing thousands of people and their families and their futures at a time when they were able to leave. Many of them, they would have been able. Telling them to stay, granted, he had very good intentions, but the result was disastrous. And as I said, I see this in my own family. The four who remained there, completely assimilated, intermarried, gone for good. My branch of the family left in about 1921 or 22. It was after the revolution. In fact, my uncle, great uncle, the older one, he was a communist in America. He was not religious in America, although in his later years he went back to religion and he became a gabbai at a shul. But he was actually named in the 1950s. He was mentioned in the Washington Star newspaper during the McCarthy hearings. He was one of the people who was named. So he had already been indoctrinated into communism in the Soviet, before it was the Soviet Union. But they left, I believe it was 1921, they came first to, they went to Omaha, Nebraska, where there was a very great rabbi named Sehersh Krasinski, and then they came to Baltimore, and the old man, my great-grandfather, Gershon, he always remained the rest of his life with a beard, looking like a Chabad, but none of his children really remained what we would call Orthodox, traditional, but none of them were really Orthodox. Even my grandfather was never really Orthodox, except when he was young. He was also a bit of a chazan. He used to go, during the time of the Pale of Settlements, when you needed special permission to go to St. Petersburg, he would go with my great-grandfather, Gershon. They would go for Yom Noraim to St. Petersburg, where the rich and special people were, and act as chazan. But already in the Soviet Union, they were not really Orthodox, I would say, my grandfather's generation. But of course, they remained in America, traditional Jews, whereas the ones who were left in the Soviet Union, by definition, there was no chinuch, there was no education, there was no nothing. So you're saying I'm no gay abadava, or it's personal? I would say the same thing if it wasn't personal. I mean, I think you have to see this as a terrible, terrible mistake, a disastrous decision to tell thousands of Hasidim who could get out and who could leave that your place is here. It's great to be a shliach and all this, and as a Lubavitcher, to try to spread the message of Judaism wherever you are. I know they all feel that that's their goal, but at the expense of their children, at the expense of their future, and it just seems to me that, not just to me, I mean, it's obvious it was a tragedy. Yeah. I'm, well, it's already 10 o'clock, so we'll pick up next time we're going to see what happens to the Ryots himself. He has to leave. He himself is thrown in jail. He's sentenced to death, actually. And he has to leave the Soviet Union, but he still remains involved. It's only later, I think it's around 1930, that he realizes that there is no future. But we're going to pick up with the story, follower of Zevin. Rav Zevin eventually has to get out as well. And we're going to pick this up. I'll ask if any questions here. Comments. Okay, Baruch says, it's claimed by the Lubavitchers that the Chafetz Chaim made a statement along the lines of, if I were young, I would say we have to fight the communists, as in the Shas HaShemad. What does that mean, fight the communists? I don't know what that means. Bar Kokhba or something? Fight the communists? The communist era was something entirely new. For the first time, maybe in 2,000 years, you had a government telling you that it was real Shas HaShemad saying that you could not observe Judaism. They were forbidding you to observe Judaism. The Rambam is clear. Take a look in the Geras HaShemad. If you're in a place where you cannot openly observe Judaism, you are obligated to get out of there as soon as possible. Granted, the Ryots thought in those years, until around 1930 or so, that it was still possible to observe Judaism, just would be very difficult. But everyone else who was there realized that it was impossible. You couldn't observe it. And on the one hand, this says great things about Chabad. Just like, who's going to Bangkok, Thailand, and trying to open up a shul there and for the tourists? Who's going to Nepal? Who's doing these things? It's not people in the yeshiva world. They believe in Kiruv, we all know that, but they believe in Kiruv and going to a place where there's a school where they can send their kids, where there's a community, and you can't blame them. You can't ask someone to move to a place where the children literally don't have a school to go to, and yet Chabad has always been willing to make those sacrifices. Today it's not as hard as it used to be because they have the internet, they do schooling online. But they would go to these places, they'd go to cities in America where there was no yeshiva. And they would homeschool their kids, and they would send their kids to public school and teach them on their own until they were maybe 6th or 7th grade, and then they'd send them off to Crown Heights or something. That's a sacrifice you can't ask anyone to make, but yet they were willing to make it. So it's all coming from a very good place, and they were willing to make this sacrifice and stay in the Soviet Union precisely because they are very selfless people. And the Rebbe is selfless, and they weren't thinking about themselves. But if you look at what it led to, it led to a complete disaster. It led to complete assimilation of all these Chabad families, these families that were cream of the crop, the best Chabad families, who were many of them were left behind the Iron Curtain. It just led to complete assimilation because you couldn't compete against the pressure, the anti-Semitism, and you literally could not have a job if you didn't work on Shabbos, and it was impossible. And as I said, it's in my own family, the four children that remain there are all completely assimilated, gone. Only one of them went to Israel. Only one of the descendants went to Israel, the direct descendants, and he was intermarried, like half these people what Israel are, and the rest, I don't even know if they're Jewish anymore. The family lost touch with them completely. Baruch says, I have heard that. No, I haven't heard that. What I've heard was that if he was younger, he would have come to America. I might have heard that he would have that, but I don't recall it. I heard that if he was younger, he would have got on the first boat and come to America, even though, because the Chafetz Chaim was the one who said, you can't go to America, it's a treifa land. But he said that if he was younger, he would, however, be the first one going there to minister to the people who were already in America. But you can't compare America to the Soviet Union. America was a midbar. There was no Judaism here. But there was all the freedom you want to have Judaism here. The Soviet Union, you literally, there couldn't, it was Judaism was illegal there. Yisrael says, couldn't move up or couldn't have any kind of a job. Exactly, there's nothing. There was no way to raise Jewish children in the Soviet Union. It was impossible. There was no schooling, there was nothing. Your kids had to go to the communist school where they were indoctrinated. That's when Rav Moshe Feinstein decided he had to leave, when he saw that he couldn't raise his children Jewish. Okay, I'll Google that. That doesn't mean it's true, but I never heard of the story. And I don't know what that means. If he was young, he would fight the communists. If it means that he'd willingly cross over the communist lines and set up shop in Moscow. I can't believe the Chafetz Chaim, who is a very smart person, as we all know, would ever say such a thing. When did it become difficult? It started, really, by 1930 it became difficult, even late 20s. Before that, you could leave. There wasn't a problem. And you could also, even when it became in the late 20s, you could still hire guides who would take you over the Polish border. Although it was illegal, you could do it. By the time you get in the 1930s, the borders were sealed, and it was very, very difficult to cross over. You still could do it. Rabbi Israeli did. And by the mid-1930s, no one could go anywhere. It was one giant prison camp and would remain a giant prison camp. I think when he said fighting, I would probably agree with Yido. I mean, what does that mean, fight? I can't for the life of me imagine it means that he would actually go into the Soviet Union. I don't know. Yisrael's grandmother left Uman in 1923, but says something about having to sneak out. So it might have even been then... but there's plenty of people who were leaving already. I don't know if she had a visa, but if you were, as long as you had a visa, you could get out. Later on, it becomes very difficult, almost impossible to get visas, and even if you get, it's not so simple to get out, so I don't know. In the early years, you could definitely get out. By the mid-20s, late-20s, it's already a problem. Okay, fine, so he's fighting. The Chafetz Chaim is taking a stand for Yiddishkeit. He did take a stand for Yiddishkeit. Yeah, the Navardic also. Exactly, they did it as well. Okay, everyone, we have a lot more to do, I think, with Rav Zevin, not just in the Soviet Union. A whole committee, as we'll see, is open. A whole group with Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, Rabbi Zevin, and two other rabbis to try to spread Judaism in the Soviet Union. Rav Zevin, as far as I know, never commented on the Seventh Rebbe's scholarship publicly, in print, but he told everyone that he admired him greatly. I mean, he never wrote anything about the Rebbe, but they engaged in great correspondence, so much so that Rav Zevin was actually, as we'll see, mevatel himself. He accepted the Lubavitcher Rebbe as his Rebbe, even though he's not a Lubavitcher. He and the Lubavitcher Rebbe were in constant contact. However, not for everything. We will see that Rav Zevin still remains a Zionist, and did not feel that he had to follow the Lubavitcher Rebbe in everything. But he pretty much subordinated himself to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and Bobrovsky itself ceases to exist. Had Rav Zevin wanted to, he could have become the Rebbe of Bobrovsky. He could have led the Hasidim in Israel, the Bobrovskers. He was that great, even though he wasn't from the family. But he subordinates himself, as do the others, to Rav Nachum Mendel Schneerson. Okay, we'll talk a little more when we get up. Yes, Rav Zevin knew Torah Kula, Rav Zevin. I will describe Rav Zevin as knowing things, as being a complete Torah personality, unlike any other in the world, except for maybe Rabbi Nachum Kasher. But we'll do this all, God willing, next class. Good night.